what he represents, he's my figure for individualism and functionalism, and in line with my previous arguments, basically the move from evolutionism to functionalism, which occurs around the time of Durkheim, who was born in 1858 and dies in 1917, this is the time of the shift over from evolutionism to functionalism. There are two main reasons that I'll mention now. One is political, as I mentioned. Evolutionism was the political philosophy of expanding European empires around the world. As I explained last time, huge inequalities of power and wealth. And so you placed the civilizations of the world on a ladder and you were at the top of it. By the time Durkheim is at his prime, 1890s, this isn't so self-evident. Japan, for instance, has become a major player in the East, is defeating China and Russia. India is getting restless. There are a lot of intelligent people questioning European imperial attitudes in India and elsewhere. America is now challenging Europe. So the confidence behind evolutionism is going, and the gross inequalities are beginning to merge. The whole thing collapses, of course, in the First World War. It's when it's apparent that the West is no more rational or anything else than anywhere else. But already it's being questioned. So there is a political shift of power. There's also an intellectual challenge, which is really that evolutionism is nonsense. Just to put it in one remark, Maitland, who I've lectured to some of you about elsewhere, points out that the strict evolutionary theory, which says that all societies must go through a series of stages, which also Marx, to a certain extent, had, is, if you observe the world, it's clearly nonsense. In Maitland's case, England didn't go through stages of all the stages of evolutionism. It didn't get Christianity by going through a whole lot of animistic and fetishistic and other stages. Someone came over to England with Christianity and told them about it. They didn't get the alphabet by going through pictographic drawing and so on and so on. They got the alphabet. So you get a phase both of diffusionism and anti-evolutionism, because it's clear that ideas and technologies and so on spread, and you don't have to have stages. This was always the problem with Marxism also, and in the Soviet Union, did you have to go through various stages, feudalism, before you could get to capitalism? And it became more and more apparent that it was all nonsense. So there are intellectual challenges. Boas, B-O-A-S in America, with his historical challenge. and many others. So I won't go into that, but you probably are aware of this. So what was going to replace this? If you couldn't have a theoretical framework based on evolutionary stages, what was the thing that explained how social systems are at the moment? And the move was to functionalism, that the explanation of phenomena is in terms of what it does in the present for that society, the metaphor of the bicycle, which I mentioned last time. And also there's a period of diffusionism where you think that ideas start in a certain part of the world and spread elsewhere, which obviously they do, but not all in one place. The over-enthusiasm of the diffusionists for the Middle East as the cradle of all ideas in the world was one of the reasons it tended to collapse. But nowadays we realize that most of what we do in the West came from China originally, or if it didn't come from China, it came from Arabic civilizations. Much of our fundamental technology and thought systems came from eastwards and wasn't invented here, but now it's going backwards and forwards. So Durkheim is a good example of this new wave of functionalism. Who was he and what was he like? Because I think this explains a good deal of the reasons why he didn't really succeed. This is the guy. I'm sorry, it's not a very good picture. There he is. Some of you said you couldn't really see. Can everyone more or less see him briefly there? I could bring him over a bit there for those who this is in the way for. Okay. I have a theory about myopia, which some of you may know. And so it doesn't surprise me that he's a myope with a very short-sightedness, as you can see there. But that's not what I mainly want to talk about. His handwriting, as you see there, is very neat and so on, very different from Weber and Tocqueville, who are all over the place and scrawling and so on. He was a meticulous, careful sort of person. So we'll leave him there. He was born in on the 15th of April in Lorraine in France. His father had been a chief rabbi, so he, like Marx, came from a rabbinical family, and he grew up within the confines of a close-knit Orthodox and traditional Jewish family, part of the long-established Jewish community in Alsace-Lorraine. He was destined to be a rabbi, and his early education was directed to that end. He's another Old Testament prophet, in other words, who lost his belief, became secular, but still has this warm, close Jewish background, which I think is what he's searching for in a lot of his work, without being too psychoanalytic about it. It was a very religious setting and upbringing, but it was later decided he would not follow the family tradition, and he dropped his Orthodox Jewish identity. So his central obsession was what holds society together. The thing that had held his own childhood together was no longer satisfactory. He later wrote of the typical Jewish community as a small society, compact and cohesive, with a very keen self-consciousness and a sense of unity. In some ways, his elementary forms of religious life is projecting some of this back into Australian Aboriginal life, as you'll see later. And his aim was really to see how he could create a cozy moral community, which wouldn't stifle the individual. He was a marginal figure, both a secular rationalist and a prophet. This came through into his everyday life. He was, as a lecturer, a preacher. A contemporary described him as follows: he appeared thin and pale in his grey jacket, with an immense head and sombre eyes, on the platform of the amphitheatre. He took up his lecture at the point where he stopped. His grave manner never brightened. Nonetheless, his speech, always somewhat subdued at the most significant moments, was not without charm, and one felt it turning into a sort of incantation. Well, lecturing is a kind of incantation anyway. But those of you who have been to good lecturers by Tony Giddens or someone like that will know what he was like. He was a very good lecturer, clear, authoritative and direct. He was like Marx in some ways, but one great difference from Marx was that Marx believed that the way to create utopia on earth, which is what both of them wanted, was through revolution, whereas Durkheim was a reformist and a gradualist. And Marx was more optimistic. He thought that communism would definitely triumph, and I think that Durkheim was always unsure about the end result. He was a pessimist. He saw the weaknesses of democracy, of modern capitalism and industrialism, and was just trying to put some correctives into them so that they would work sufficiently well. He was in many ways an alienated and frustrated thinker, full of anxiety and pessimism. He worked obsessively, overworked obsessively, and had a number of mental breakdowns, probably through overwork. And he died at the age of 59 through that combination of overwork and the grief, it said, at the loss of his only son in the First World War. His reputation, as you know, is very great. He's one of the great triumvirate, Marx, Weber, Durkheim, and maybe in terms of institutional patterns and what he conveyed on to the next generation, he deserves that. But I think in terms of the ideas, I'm not so sure. But his failure, I think, is very instructive, and I think you can tell the story of his life through his problem and how he tried to solve it and why he, to my mind, failed. The problem he's trying to solve is how you hold societies together now. So using the Sherlock Holmes method of let's eliminate the impossible ways of holding a modern industrial society. This is France, Germany, 1880s. We've had the Industrial Revolution. We've got high geographical and social mobility. We've got cities. How are we going to hold this thing together? This is his problem. He says the object of sociology as a whole is to determine the conditions for the conservation of societies. That's the functionalist side. How can we hold societies together? He knew that the traditional methods of doing this, which is kinship and the family, won't work. You can't hold a modern industrial society together by corporate kin groups. You can't hold it together, as he discovered in his own life, by religion. There are no natural communities left. People are milling around too much. So how in the post-French revolutionary, post-industrial world are we going to have integration? Basically, it's the problem that afflicts all late 19th century sociologists and anthropologists. We've got to move from Gemeinschaft, that is community, to Gesellschaft, that is association, from status, in Mayn's terms, to contract, from sacred to profane, and we've got all this social atomization. The erosive effects of hyper-individualism, of the type of individualism that, or selfishness that Tocqueville talks about, is the problem for sociology. How is it going to overcome this? And the depth of the problem is illustrated in one of his books, his book on suicide, which is a later book, 1897, is of course one of his most successful books because it's analyzing what is the problem. The problem illuminated there, and I did find this book very interesting, is that there are high rates of suicide in many industrial societies. And as you know, there are different kinds of suicide. There's egotistic suicide, where you just go out and show that you're a great person or whatever it is and jump off the canoe. There's altruistic suicide, dying for someone else. But then there's anomic suicide. There's the kind which is caused by the disintegration of all social ties. You feel alone, purposeless, pointless, and you jump into the camp. The highest suicide rates in Britain in the 17th century were at Byron's Pool, what's called Byron's Pools at Grantchester. People were puzzled why there was such a high suicide rate in that area, and of course it was and undergraduates going for picnics and then getting depressed, jumping in. Anyway, his view is summarized by Lukes. The best book on his life and thought is by Stephen Lukes, the sociologist. Long book, but very worthwhile, who says his theory is as follows, that under adverse social conditions, when men's social context fails to provide them with the requisite sources of attachment and or regulation at the appropriate level of intensity, then their psychological or moral health is impaired and a certain number of vulnerable, suicide-prone individuals respond by committing suicide. They feel like that much of the time, and of course they mainly do it in April, which is one of the interesting points he made, was that there are statistical rules which govern our behaviour. You can't predict which undergraduate is going to jump into the pool, but you can predict that more of them will do it in April than in June or May. There are certain months when suicide rates go up, there are certain socioeconomic groups and so on. So there are statistical rules governing our life, which he shows very well in that book. So if the world is subject to this disintegration and anomie, rootlessness, formlessness, lack of meaning, of individualism, how are we going to overcome this if we can't do it through the family and religion, or even through the general will, through a general kind of getting together that Rousseau had suggested in his totalitarian explanation? The main theory around him at this time was that we'll do it through contract. This is the main theory of movement from status to contract. We will agree to be nice to each other. We will enter into thousands of contracts, not just written contracts, but the kind of contract I mentioned before, that between you and me, you're sitting here politely writing your notes, and I'm standing here politely talking to you. This is a contract. We haven't written anything down, but that's a kind of contract. And many people thought, well, advanced industrial capitalist societies can run themselves fairly well as long as we abide by lots and lots of little contracts with each other. His criticism of this was that this disguises the fact that firstly, contract is very weak. If our interests change, we may enter into a temporary contract, but then we can just say, well, the situation has changed. If I started going completely insane here, lecturing and going on about how I love George Bush and how he was my and things like that, you would probably all march out, I hope. So the contract would be broken by my behavior. So contract is a pretty weak vehicle. Secondly, as he pointed out, and is also true, contract is a fetish. We're actually, contract can't work unless there's a whole underpinning of a particular legal and political and ideological system. You can't enter into contracts with people you don't trust, you don't have some similarity with very easily. In effect, he says, the contract is par excellence, the juridical expression of cooperation. You need to want to cooperate and feel cooperative and have your cooperation supported. So in sum, a contract is not sufficient unto itself, but is possible only thanks to a regulation of the contract, which is originally social. So the social has to precede the contract. The free-floating individuals of capitalism are an illusion. The contracts are there because there is a social uniformity. So it just disguises the problem. Something has got to create that social unity before you get the contractual system working. So he then tries to solve this problem with his own theories. His first one is the division of labour in society, 1893. Basically, when I was writing these lectures, I suddenly realised an easy way to explain to you. Basically, simpler societies, and he's making a contrast between, say, tribal societies and modern societies, simpler societies are mechanical. Now this again, all these people choose the wrong words. We tend to think of simple societies as not being mechanical, but anyway he uses this word mechanical, and what he means is that simple societies are basically like worms. If you've ever had to dissect a worm, which I'm glad I've never had to do, but I imagine that there are a whole lot of rings, and this is your worm. All the rings are the same. So you get all your lineages or corporate groups or whatever it is. They're homologously similar. There's no division of labour. Everyone does everything more or less. There may be a slight sexual division of labour, but that's all. So it's homologous, and that is mechanical solidarity. What holds it together is everyone more or less the same. Organic solidarity, which is quite counterintuitive, and what is the system that we now have in our society, is basically the division of labour. It's that different people do different things, and what holds us together here is rather like, say, Dumont's theory of the caste system, that there's a division of labour. The Brahmins are the head, the Kshatriya are the arms, the Shudra and the Vaishya and so on are the body and the legs and the rest of it. And each person, or in a feudal system, the warriors, the clergy, the peasants, the bourgeois, they all do different things. What holds such an organic system together is the very oppositions and differences. I can't get on. If I'm a hand, I'm no use. It's not just a matter of one hand clapping. You've got to have the arm as well and all the rest of your body. So what will hold together modern societies is an increasing division of labour. So basically the more modern society advances, the more integrated it will become, counterintuitively, because there'll be more and more people depending on each other. So rather than Adam Smith's idea that the division of labour increases economic efficiency, his theory is that it's mainly advances because it increases social integration. And it leads you to like each other. And this is where the idea begins to collapse. He assumes that the division of labour is spontaneous and voluntary in order to make it effective, affective, feelingful. He says the division of labour produces solidarity only if it is spontaneous and in proportion as it is spontaneous. Now, most people who go into jobs don't like that division of labour. Anyone who's watched anyone doing most of the jobs done in the city, whether it's a cash till operative or a bus driver or most of the jobs, are ones which you go into voluntarily in the sense that you have to have a job and you have to have money, but you don't go in there feeling an elation of heart that this is the very job you've been looking forward to doing all your life. In other words, you are forced to a certain extent into the division of labour. Also, he believes that when people are in these jobs, they feel a moral uplift, that they're doing something really worthwhile and contributing, and other people are contributing and so on. My experience of doing those kinds of jobs occasionally suggests that you don't feel this at all. you feel a sense of alienation and meaninglessness and pointlessness much of your life. So I think it's a very unrealistic psychological premise on which he bases this idea. So as I put it here, it's not self-evident the inner of a, the third thing is that his idea is that the people who set up this division of labour also are altruistic and trying to set it up to make life pleasant for the people they work with, so that the owner of a supermarket is trying to create social solidarity when he puts all the girls along, or men along, to at the checkout points. And Durkheim's idea, he sort of has a dim idea that perhaps they aren't very happy and they don't quite see the point of what they're doing in the greater scheme of things. So he says, as long as you explain to them, look, you're not just working for Sainsbury's here, you're working for the community, and so on, then people think, oh, well, that's fine then. Crazy. In fact, if you don't believe that this is a travesty, which it is to a certain extent, an oversimplification, he himself realized it was nonsense, I think, because one of the interesting things about his life is that after publishing that book, he never refers to it again. I mean, he may have said on his CV that he had written this book, but it never plays any major part in his later theoretical development at all. He more or less abandons it as a failure, which it is. It's interesting. I mean, there is one central interesting point which all of us can maintain, that our society is, to a certain extent, held together by the division of labour. In one sense, we do depend on each other, but it isn't a solution to moral integration and social integration. It's also shown to be unsatisfactory because it's based on an opposition, which some of you may come across, so I'll mention it, between two types of legal system. He says that in lower societies, law is almost exclusively penal and almost exclusively very stationary. Law in modern societies, on the contrary, is restitutive rather than repressive. Repressive laws are those that punish, you know, lop off your hand or flog you or something like that. Restitutive ones are ones which take you and say, you know, you must return something to someone. Most anthropologists who've studied law at all, and he hadn't actually studied it, know that it's more or less the opposite, that in most societies, if famous case, the Noah, if you have sexual relations and you're found out, you pay a fine. Our society is mainly constituted by a legal system which is heavily repressive. Huge numbers of people sitting in jails or being punished in physical ways for acts which in many societies they would be put under ritual or social sanctions. So he's got it completely upside down. Okay, next attempt, occupational groups. He never wrote a book on occupational groups, but it was raised in a lecture in 1892. And for about 10 years, he worked on the theory that perhaps the way to integrate societies was to find some way in which people felt part of a group, but a modern group. In the preface to the second edition of The Division of Labour, which is a good place to study his new ideas on this, he more or less gives up the division of labour theory, but he puts in a new theory, this one, and also in the lectures originally delivered between 1890 and 1900 and published as Professional Ethics, he gives an outline of what he thinks could be a solution. The problem, I think, is he's right, that there's a lack of belongingness, and there's also a danger that the state, he realizes the danger that after the French Revolution, the state is becoming more and more powerful, the individual is becoming weaker and weaker, and one of the things that you need to put in place is civil society of some kind. You need a balance, intermediary institutions, pluralism, and so on. So you need, as he often says, corporate groups between the state and the citizen, both to protect you politically and to give you social meaning. A nation, he says, can be maintained only if, between the state and the individual, there is a whole series of secondary groups near enough to the individuals to attract them strongly in their sphere of action and drag them in this way into the general torrent of social life. And it also gives moral integration. The state can't provide you with a meaning to your life. It can tell you what to do and not to do, but it can't make you feel this is right, this is wrong, in a moral way. And these groups would create warmth, break down narrow individualism and egotism, and create a sense of meaning in life. Well, he says, what we especially see in the occupational group is a moral power capable of containing individual egos. Originally, this had been done by the family. And in the medieval period, it had been done by the occupational guild. And at the moment, it's being done by our secretaries who decided to put up shelves in the middle of a lecture in characteristic spontaneous enthusiasm. I was very careful with my words there, since some of you may be very close to our secretaries. It's given me a chance for a cup of tea anyway, glass of tea. Now, so there had been these groups. There'd been associations, there'd been guilds, there'd been cities, and so on and so on. But they'd all been wiped away. He accepts the sort of vision that came up in Tocqueville and others, that these intermediate associations over much of Europe had been destroyed by the unifying state measures of France, Germany, and so on. So they no longer, the medieval guilds were swept away, all the associations, they were all banned. You just had the state and the citizen. What's surprising about his view, unlike these other people, is that he thinks this is a very good thing. He says, since the 18th century rightfully suppressed the old corporations, that's his words, there's been nothing to replace them. The effect of modernity is to have swept away cleanly all the older forms of social organization. There are none of them left. Let's start again. Basically, the new entities are based on profession. So you'd have a group of academics, a group of doctors, a group of dustmen, a group of farmmen, whatever it is, who would get together, form a trade association, occupational group, and then feel good about being part of it, and they would have a meaning, and this, the fireman would stand between the state and the individual, and so on. I won't quote him on this, but if you're interested, you can see it on the website. They would be property-owning, perpetual corporations. They'd be a sort of surrogate family for people, an elementary sort of unit between the state and the individual. But he's extremely vague on how they would work, as commentators have said. Parkin, who's one of the good commentators, says, Durkheim is characteristically vague when it comes to the organizational structure of the guilds. He also falls into all sorts of difficulties. First of all, the state, and this is the main difficulty, who makes these guilds? The state. The state sets up the organization of dustmen or farmmen, gives it its charter, and he says it's very essential, since they might cause trouble for the state, that the state interferes in everyday life of these organizations. They are extensions of the state. The state must, he says, must even permeate all those secondary groups of family, trade, and professional associations, church, regional areas, and so on, which tend, as we've seen, to absorb the personality of their members. It must do this in order to prevent this absorption and free these individuals. So the state must go right down. When they have their annual general meeting, the state should get the minutes. And if it doesn't like something, it says you're doing the wrong thing there. It's basically the old corporationism writ large. It's total interference. It's not civil society. It's state-allowed civil society, and therefore not a recipe either for freedom or congeniality. As I've lectured in terms of Maitland, the whole point about civil society is that it is independent of the state to a large extent. It's non-corporate groups, and he doesn't understand this. And I think this undermines the whole endeavor, which again, he tries for about 10 years and then it lapses because he really doesn't get anywhere. So that's his second attempt. His third is the most interesting to us as anthropologists, so I'll just give you a moment to have a break, and then we'll get on to that one, which is his theory of religion. Are there any sort of specific points, names, dates I can help with. How many of you have read any Durkheim? Most of you. See, we're getting onto known territory. How many of you think I'm being very horrible to Durkheim? Quite horrible to Durkheim. Yes, quite horrible. Okay. I'll be a bit nicer for the next little bit. Yes, I think it does. Yes, I think so. The egotistical, I think it does. There's the same framework behind suicide as the division of labor, to a large extent. Movement from one kind of suicide in mechanical societies to a different kind of suicide. Well, suicide is 97, yes, it's true, there's 4 years. I mean, there is some overlap, but that's 3 or 4 years, the ideas are still milling around in his mind. Okay, so religion. His most interesting work for us is his late and largest book, The Elementary Forms of the Religious Life. This is really, in some ways, an admission of defeat. He hasn't got a solution to modern industrial society. So he says, let's go back to the earliest, simplest case and start again. Let's go back to the Australian Aborigines as described by recent anthropologists Elkin and others and see what holds their societies together, because perhaps if we can find that out, then we can bring it back and use it here. He absorbs the ideas to a certain extent of Spencer, Gillen and Robertson Smith on the Semitic sacrifice, and it boils down to the famous proposition, which he wasn't the first. I mean, Marx had said the same thing, but basically you often use the word Durkheim and Durkheimian as an adjective to describe this idea, which is that religion is a projection of this world, this society. In fact, it's Durkheimian is more than that. Religion is a projection of this world, and this world then is ordered by religious categories. So it works upwards and downwards like this, back and forth. So society reflects religion and religion reflects society. Let's look first at his definition of religion. It's a system of ideas by means of which people represent to themselves the society of which they are members and the opaque but intimate relations they have with it. This is its essential function. It's a way of talking about the world. That is what religion is. Tell you how your world works. And this is where it's most fruitful, mainly through his nephew, Marcel Mauss, who is a great anthropologist and thinker. Basically, religion provides us with our categories of thought. He says that the most essential notions of the human mind question notions of time, of space, of genus and species, of force and causality, of personality, those in a word which the philosophers have labelled categories and which dominate the whole of logical thought have been elaborated in the very womb of religion. It is from religion that science has taken them. And that is a fruitful and interesting idea. Religion also reflects and organises the conscience collective, which you can't translate into English. It's not collective conscience, so to speak. He defines it as the set of beliefs and sentiments common to the average members of a single society, which forms a determinate system that has its own life. Sort of what Bourdieu means by habitus, really. Set of commonly held assumptions about the world. And that's the conscience collective. And these are shaped by religion. His comment about how religion works like science is interesting, because he is one of the first who basically argues that modern science is identical to religion. He puts the explanations of contemporary science are surer of being objective because they are more methodical and because they rest on more rigorously controlled observation, but they do not differ in nature from those which satisfy primitive thought. So he's an anticipator of Kuhn, Latour, and these people who basically say science is another way of talking about the world on a continuum with religion, not just an entirely different one. The twist, as I mentioned, is that while religion gives us our categories of thought, religion itself is generated by society. The classification of things reproduces the classification of men, as he put it around the about the Australian tribes. The two go back and forth. Cosmic, another quotation, cosmic space was primitively constructed on the model of social space, that is, on the territory occupied by a society and as society conceives it. Time expresses the rhythm of collective life. The notion of class was at first no more than another aspect of the human group. And that is interesting, very interesting, the idea that the seasons and the rhythms of the seasons may be reflected in the cosmologies. And then the cosmologies affect your perception of the seasons. How did this happen? How did society influence religion? And here he goes on to his famous distinction between the sacred and the profane. This is different. Most of us, probably in Christian thought, make a distinction between the natural and the supernatural. There's a line that this world is natural, then there's a supernatural above that. He cuts it in a different way. He says there's certain things are sacred and certain things are profane. This is a bipartite division of the whole universe, known and knowable, into two classes, which embrace all that exists, but which radically exclude each other. And this is the classic definition. Sacred things are those which the interdictions, that's prohibitions, protect and isolate. Profane things are those to which those interdictions are applied. So there are some things which are sacred, some things that are profane. And religion is about projecting some of these sacred principles. An example would be the totemic beliefs of the Australian Aboriginals. I can see it's an interesting distinction, but I can't see, and it works if you have a certain kinds of religious system, an opposition between sacred and profane. It's very difficult, particularly in a Protestant secular world now, to decide what is sacred and what is profane. If it's a matter of interdictions plus a feeling, slight feeling of reverence or awe, then everything tends to merge in. There are moments in your life when you feel a sense of awe, but sometimes it has nothing to do with religion. For example, the tokonoma in a Japanese tea ceremony or tea house is you can't go up and throw things at it. It is a sort of special area. It's also, you treat it with a certain respect. But there's no God there, there's no religion involved. The King's College lawn, now is that sacred or is that profane? It's an area where none of you are allowed to walk, I'm glad to say, except for me. There's strong interdictions all around it. There's a sense of reverence, certainly from the number of foreign tourists who take photographs of it. There's something special about this lawn, but you know, it would be travesty of language to call it sacred, really. So once you get into Protestantism, the distinctions begin to become rather difficult. But it's worth thinking about. What is also worth thinking about is his general ideas, how you create this feeling of sacredness. And this takes you, basically, this takes you to another of his famous theories, which is that it's created through ritual and collective activities. Basically, if you get together, drink a large amount and dance around, putting it over simply, i.e. the end of term mingle, is your experience of such collective effervescence, as he calls it, something will come out of it. The corroboree is the example. Of course, he hates not a Cambridge mingle, but the Australians, you know, they drum and they dance and they chant and sort of something comes up, and collective effervescence, and everyone feels a sense of being belonging. A football crowd is another example. Such effervescence recreates the central core of society. You feel together, oneness, and so on. And that's This is the function of ritual: to create effervescence, generate and restore social memory, increase moral density. And he thought he saw all this in Australian Aboriginals. They often, the groups live far apart. They come together once or twice a year, and then they feel a sense of coming togetherness, like a sort of communion. And this comes from the ideas of Robertson Smith and others on primitive communion. It's a suggestive idea. All of us know the effect of crowd behavior on making you feel part, especially with a bit of drink and loud music or equivalent and dancing. You feel togetherness, and so there's something in it, but it can often not lead to any kind of religious manifestation. It can often be just secular, so it has to be thought about a bit. As for the book as a whole, there are lots of criticisms of it. If you're interested, one of the most scathing is by Evans Pritchard, who was in some ways a disciple of Durkheim. He took some of his ideas, but in his History of Anthropological Thought, there's a short piece on Durkheim in which he demolishes him from top to bottom. Arnold van Gennep, who wrote The Rites of Passage, also was absolutely scathing. This is quoted in Luke's book, page 525. Within 10 years, his whole Australian systematization will be completely rejected, and along with the generalizations he has constructed on the most fragile set of ethnographic data which I know. The idea he has derived from them of a primitive man and of simple societies is entirely erroneous. And Luke's, if you're interested, on pages 477 following, 521 following, 159, goes through all the different criticisms of this book. Even the sacred profane distinction has been rejected by subsequent anthropologists like Stanner. And the whole tautological circular notions and definitions of religion is highly questionable. So why, although you know, there's lots of intriguing stuff there, why in the end does one feel, at least I feel, very unsatisfied about his attempt as compared to these other great thinkers? And I think this is where I now come to his method in the last 4 or 5 minutes. The data wasn't very good, I mean, but usually you can get around data if you think carefully, and other people have done better. But I think the methodology, if you read his Rules of Sociological Method of 1895, compare it with Weber or any of the other people who wrote about rules, I find it a very unsatisfactory book. Has one or two good methods. He has the method of elimination, as I've mentioned before. Let's get rid of implausible explanations or theories. He advocates the comparative method, as his predecessors had done, but he doesn't use it. He's a very provincial thinker. Apart from Australian Aborigines, there's nothing outside, really, France. He doesn't even consider England or Germany. It doesn't surprise me that Max Weber never took any notice of him. Admittedly, he never took any notice of Max Weber either, but it's just France, recent France. Not England, not America. It doesn't draw on a wide comparative framework. It doesn't compare civilizations. He is good in that he uses models and compares what he calls pathological states as leading to suicide to normal states which don't lead to suicide. So he's aware of the use of models. And there's some interesting discussion of that. as for his discussion of what causes what, which was a central feature of Montesquieu and these earlier thinkers, there is no discussion of this. He doesn't have any theory of causation, as far as I can see. He hardly pays any attention to the question of levels of causation, types of causation, chains of causation. And indeed, his sociology, and this is why it's so empty, is based on a really preposterous contention, which is that social thinkers can only deal with statistical patterns. They can't deal with individual cases or accidents. He says the accidental must be removed from social science, for there can be no science of accidents, and the task of a social science is to concentrate on those uniformities and regularities in human behavior which are plainly not dominated by accident. Well, much of life, admittedly, you can't have a real scientific theory of it, but much of social life is accidental, one-off, etc., etc. And if we just say that's not sociology, it narrows it down hugely. As far as causal links are concerned, so far as he discusses it, he takes the preposterous view that you can only deal with direct causal one-to-one causal links. Sociology can't deal with multi-causal events because you can't weigh the virtue. You can only deal with cases where A leads to B or doesn't lead to B. You can't deal with a case where A and B lead to C. He explicitly wrote that if there was more than one cause for an event, it would make it too difficult to be sure of an invariable relationship, and therefore you can't deal with it. Well, again, that leaves out most of human life. I could go on. You can read about it. But basically, his functional method is what has all the faults of functionalism that we know. And just the last point. Is that his definition of social facts? He says what sociology is about is social facts. And he never really defines a social fact. Social facts must be studied as things. Our fundamental principle is the objective reality of social facts. Luke tries to say what he thinks for social fact is. He should be understood to mean social phenomena or factors or forces. But he defines it every way of acting, fixed or not, capable of exercising over the individual and external constraint is a social fact. Now, that makes everything social fact or nothing. Fox hunting is a social fact. Picking your nose is a social fact. Coughing is a social fact. Having a cup of tea, which I'm just about to do, is a social fact. So the object of sociology becomes too general, too specific. Now, I hope you don't mind being so critical about this guy. It is a corrective. As you know, I worship all the other people I'm talking about. So I think I'm allowed one person I have a grouse about. So don't take everything I said. Take it with a health warning. And if you like the guy, go on liking him. Weber next week. Thank you.